Hi there, and welcome to a new episode of Sensational, the Special Educational Needs Podcast, which is brought to you by Witherslack Group. My name is Claire, I'm the events manager for the group, and today we'll be looking at something which has been a focus in all of our lives for a number of years now, and it could probably be a podcast series in itself, really, as it has so many threads to it, and that is the impact of COVID-19 on neurodiverse children and young people. So whilst there really is an epic amount of topics to discuss, for today, we're just going to highlight the key things we believe have had the biggest impact on neurodiverse children and young people during the pandemic. And so hopefully we'll be able to provide some practical support to families that they can put into place at home. So today, I'm delighted to welcome back to the podcast one of our favourite guests, and that is Emma Weaver, Director of the Neurodiversity Early Years Service, which is part of the ADHD Foundation. So Emma, before we get started, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself and your work?
Yeah, no problem. Hi, everybody. And hi, Claire. It's really lovely to be back doing the podcast. They are my favourite. I like to chat, so it's a lovely opportunity to chat. So yeah, as Claire said, my name's Emma Weaver. My role at the ADHD Foundation is I specialise in early years and key stage one at primary, but I also work as part of the national training team as well. So I think I've got the best job in the world, mainly because I work with our little ones. So I work with children who are often haven't been identified as having a neuro developmental condition, or are in the early stages of being identified as having neurodevelopmental needs. So I like to kind of the opportunity to kind of explore with parents and with carers, with teachers and with the children themselves, kind of the path of neurodivergence, really. And I think it's a great opportunity to get that early understanding out there.
Of course, definitely. So, yeah, which is so important. Okay, that's fantastic, Emma. So let's begin our discussions now. So to begin with, I think when I look at my children, possibly the biggest impact has been the isolation and the loss of time for them. And, you know, by that, I mean, you know, time with their friends and family, time to be social and learn, and time to just be the age that they were then when it all started. So in your opinion, what would you say the biggest impact has been for neurodiverse children?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think thinking about losses,
yeah,
and change. You know, I think for some children, the kind of COVID pandemic, particularly lockdowns, for some children they were having the time of their lives. Particularly for our children who were struggling with social communication difficulties, we were having lots and lots of parents that we were supporting right the way through the lockdowns, and I was kind of on video calls to parents and to children of all different ages, where parents were saying, the fear actually is getting them back into the world and getting back into school and environments. And I think what we're seeing is the impact of COVID has been socially quite significant on a few of our children. And it's either been related to confidence and anxiety around getting back into the world. I've certainly worked with children of all different age ranges, particularly our teenagers. We've seen where there's been anxiety around social experiences. And, you know, when you think,
because they've missed out on so much, haven't they, of that, the building up of the learning of social experiences and stuff.
Yeah, I also think one of the difficulties has been the messaging that we've had around don't get too close to people and, you know.
Yeah, of course. I mean, even now, sometimes I'm still a little bit like, oh, does this person want me to be going near them and everything? You like, you know, you sort of became like a COVID soldier in a way, didn't you? You were just adhering to all these rules.
And I think that's that for our children who have neurodiverse conditions, is the challenge is actually them being able to navigate that. You know, it's told for such a long time, I can't touch you, or I can't get too close to you, or I can't function. So one of the things, we work across schools, and we're seeing in a lot of the schools, you know, the bubble systems have gone now. Mm-hmm. So now children are sharing canteen spaces, they're sharing outdoor areas together. And actually the anxiety, I think that's one of the, I suppose, if we were to say the biggest impact, I think, has been on children's level of anxieties around
about
what they've gone through as well, and then opportunities to kind of to use skills in social socializing with others have been challenged because of that as well.
So as I was saying earlier, you know, we can't look at this topic without mentioning mental health. So as an organisation, what have you seen the biggest effects on children's mental health to be? And what are the key things we as parents, carers, teachers, or anyone supporting children should be looking out for, you know, if a child really is in distress?
Yeah, I think mental health is a really important point to be.
It's massive. Yeah.
It's huge. And I think even with our little ones, you know,
a
lot of the role that we do in the early years service is play-based interventions and helping children understand emotions. I think for me, when I think about a child in distress, no matter what age they are, I always think about what's their interpretation of the situation. So what is it that they have, what is the distress, I suppose? What lens are they looking at it through?
Mm-hmm.
I think as parents of children with neurodivergent kind of conditions, we're constantly analysing. You know, it's that constantly analysing what is it that my child is telling me through their behaviors or through their distress.
What does that mean? And
and often that's really sometimes piecing that together can be really, really hard,
tricky.
I think your first kind of starting point is label it when you see it. You know, if you see a child struggling either to regulate their feelings or they're struggling to understand situations, label it without questions. I think sometimes questions can increase the distress. So just if you can see your child looking worried, just validate it. I think that you're worried at the moment. Some children will just kind of go, we'll take that and they'll absorb that and walk away. Other children might see it as an opportunity to go, I am actually, and this is what I'm
and start talking.
But I think, so being mindful of the emotion that your child is experiencing, I think is a really important point. But also being mindful of what the trigger for the distress is, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we have to dig quite deep for that. I think for lots of our parents, the parents that we meet kind of in our day-to-day kind of practice, is I'm always saying about upskilling yourself. Upskill your knowledge of what ADHD is, what autism is, what the traits of those conditions are. Because if you can then start to understand sensory processing difficulties are often a difficulty for our children on the autistic spectrum. Actually, maybe the distress is because we're now back in loud, busier environments and my child struggles with that. So it's that kind of putting your Inspector Morse hat on, isn't it?
But I think doing a bit of digging.
Yeah, but we can only analyse when we've got the knowledge, I think.
Yes, yeah, so I think, yeah, to give you that full circle.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that, I suppose that's coming from the parent side of things. I think also what's really important is enabling our children and young people to develop the strategies that they need when they're feeling like that as well.
Yeah, so, of course.
You know, providing them with lots of opportunities to, you know, this, we are so lucky we're in that technology kind of era, aren't we?
Yeah.
Much more than I do.
Far more. Exactly. That's just what I was going to say. Our kids know far more than I do.
Yeah. You know, it can be used in lots of really positive ways as well. You know, there's lots of online communities. I know TikTok, I did a thing last night for, it was Neurodiversity Celebration Week, and we had a teen. She was a young adult called Ellie Middleton, and she's on TikTok, she's on Instagram, but she basically talks about neurodivergence from her perspective.
Yeah.
She's ADHD, awaiting an autism diagnosis, but a real positive speaker. And I was looking at her thinking, you are just what a young person needs to
hear.
I think sometimes if it comes from somebody with experience who is of a similar age bracket
and has gone through all the highs and lows and everything like that, they're speaking from a position of power and knowledge, aren't they? You know, they've been through it type of thing.
Absolutely. You know, and there's also, you know, we've got access to, there's been a comic written, which is called The Umbrella Gang, which...
Yeah, which is fantastic.
That's downloaded from the ADHD Foundation website.
And it's just,
I always feel like when it, from my perspective, I always think when you know what you're managing... So if we put a label, and it doesn't necessarily need to be a label, we talk about identifiers. So if I'm struggling with anxiety, if somebody identifies that in me, I can do something about it. And if I understand what the word anxiety means, I can then go, right, I'm struggling with anxiety at the moment. I'm going to go and look at resources that are going to help me to manage that anxiety.
Yeah, yeah.
So sometimes that kind of self-awareness can be really helpful too.
Yeah, definitely.
But I think it can be frightening for some for us to sometimes have
acknowledge it.
But I think it's there's a lot of value in that, because when you understand yourself and you kind of, I suppose it's that you find your tribe, don't you? And this is what Ellie was saying.
Yeah.
You kind of, when you see other people in the same positions, maybe expressing what they've experienced, but then telling you what they've done to help themselves.
Yes.
It becomes something that you can relate to, I think.
Yeah, a normalized sort of thing, isn't it, in a way for that person.
Definitely.
Okay, so moving on, you know, I already mentioned the loss before in terms of loss of time, but what about for those children who have actually, you know, sadly lost someone close to them? How can families help them through what is a really difficult time, especially when we consider their neurodiversity as well? You know, even explaining loss might be difficult for some children, mightn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And I think children who are neurodiverse can sometimes be very literal in their interpretation of things. And I've worked with children where there's been loss in a family, and they've been very matter of fact about it. And for us as adults, it's like, wow, you know, I have one child, and I remember it was very much they've died and that's it.
Yeah.
What we learned over time with this child, though, was that they were internalizing what had happened, and they were internalizing the fact that this big event had happened. People around me are struggling with their emotions and managing the big event that's happening, but I don't understand the big event that's happened. So I always think being really clear, being really honest and really transparent is important. That can be really hard for us as adults to do because we're struggling with the experience. Lovely things that you can do to start with, just as introductions into exploring loss. You know, memory boxes can be really lovely. I've worked with children where we've gone and we've got a shoebox and they've decorated it, and it might be a shoebox about granddad or a shoebox that's about mom or sister or the person that I've lost. And you just fill that shoebox with memories. You know, it might be that you've got things that were their favourite things or certain smells that were really important. But, you know, having that encapsulating.
It's a lovely idea. It's a really lovely idea.
So alongside memory boxes, which can just be a really lovely way, I think what I tend to find with children who are neurodivergent is when they've got something to hold on to, you know, when they've got something that they can kind of physically hold on to, related to someone, I suppose it makes it concrete, which I think can be a really lovely way of exploring kind of grief and loss with children.
Yeah.
Smells are really important. Aftershave bottles or perfume bottles or clothes, things like that can be really useful as well. We call it multi-sensory approaches. Mm-hmm. Those things can be really helpful. There's also, you know, bereavement counselling services. If you've got a child or a young person that's particularly really struggling, you know, there's the likes of Cruise Bereavement. They have a website that can be really useful. A number of years ago, I worked with a child who'd lost a grandparent, and there's Winston's Wish.
And that's a
wonderful charity that facilitates counselling. They've got lots and lots of resources out there around how to support children and young people in particular.
Yeah.
Can be really helpful. But you also might find in your local community or local area that there
might be.
When I worked in Chester, which is in the northwest of the country, we referred a child through the local hospice. So the local hospice actually had outreach services. So they weren't, the child's family member wasn't in that hospice, but as a charity, they wanted to reach out to the community and provide support
in that way.
So could be places to start as well if there's parents listening to the podcast and wanting to seek that support.
Thanks, Emma. That's all really good stuff there. So going on to our next question now, when it comes down to it, children really have been affected in so many ways. But if we want to look at some practical strategies on how we can support moving forward, let's look at breaking it down, you know, into social support, educational support and mental health. So when we focus on these areas, what would your advice be to parents and carers wanting to positively support their child in each of those areas?
Yeah, I think it's the social one for me that's kind of would be up there in the sense of lots of the children that we meet struggle with their social kind of experiences and find socializing very difficult.
Yeah.
But sometimes we look at socializing through the lens of our social worlds. So for me, socializing is being surrounded by lots of people, you know, maybe, you know, going to clubs and having like meetups with people. But for some children, where social situations are difficult, they might have actually found an online social world that's actually of support to them. It might kind of be, you know, there's we've got to be careful with online social support.
Definitely.
There's positives and negatives to it. But for some children, they found, you know, they found people online.
Yeah.
It could be, I work with a child who, it's not a stranger online because he's too young and we're really conscious of, you know, safety online. Mm-hmm. But he socializes with friends from school, you know, playing on games on his Xbox. So he's still getting those social experiences, but we're doing it in that kind of slowly. We're then we're going to build him up. So the plan is he does it online and he does it in his bedroom, his gaming chair, and he's having a great time. But then we're then going to build it up. And the next time is his friend will come round and they'll play the game together. And then it'll be built up even further where it might be like a gaming afternoon with a few friends. Just in order to, I suppose I always say, meet them where they are to begin with. So if a child is socializing, but they might be socializing kind of in a way that we might not see as a typical way of socializing, but it's still a social element, then meet them there as long as it's appropriate and then build on that slowly. I think sometimes the whipping the band-aid off kind of analogy we sometimes hear, it can be useful for some children, but other children it can make them particularly
like withdraw sort of thing.
So it's just about recognizing where does your child get their social kind of fitness from. I also think from an educational perspective, thinking about that other kind of element we were going to focus on, is that when they are in education, when they are in schools, they're socializing every day. So you know, that social actually the expectation of them every single day in school is to be sociable, whether that's just answering a question because your teacher's asked you a direct question, or whether that's sitting next to somebody in the lunch
or lunch or whatever.
All of those things are social elements. So actually when they come in from school, if they just need to have a sit down and a relax, they've done enough socializing for the day. And then thinking about that educational slant as well, you know, getting back into learning, children have, our learning styles have changed. We've learned actually that some, you know, what we've learned, there's been some strengths to what we've learned. You know, we've learned that actually children on laptops, if that engages their learning, then how brilliant is that?
I can only speak for what I've seen with my children, and I know that they have these two apps that they use for their maths that they would sit and play on for ages and ages. They play on, but they're learning, you know, they're going up levels and stuff like that. But if you ask them to sit down and do some, like, you know, maths worksheets 5 minutes each night, they'd be like running a mile sort of thing, you know, but they're quite happy to sit and do 5 minutes for each of these little apps and play. And sometimes they're saying, oh, I just want to do a bit more, because they enjoy it. It just having that app, I don't know, it just creates, it makes it fun, I guess, for them.
Yeah, it's just a different way of engaging in learning, isn't it? And I think particularly for our children who have, you know, neurodiverse needs, I think for me, anything that is not just sitting with a piece of paper and a pen or a pencil, you know, I've touched on multisensory before, but multisensory learning is things like, and even our teenagers love it. They'll say that they don't because it doesn't look cool, but you know, whilst they're doing a little bit of writing or doing a little bit of reading, having a blob of blue tack to kind of faff with how you're doing it,
play with,
all of those things can be really helpful. I always think learning comes to life when you interact with the learning. So interaction with learning is moving your body, touching stuff, you know, like, and I think that's a really effective way. I think asking a child to sit behind a piece of paper and a pen, especially if they've got challenges with dyslexia or dysgraphia and other, you know, co-occurring conditions as well, it's like it's really difficult for them. So I think use the strengths of what COVID brought us. You know, there have been a couple of silver linings to a really horrible time, and I think that silver lining is we've learned how our children learn, for good and for bad in some ways. But I think we've learned that we can engage children in different ways of learning as well, and it's just
that. Definitely. Okay, so have we got anything to, I mean, we've touched on mental health already. Have you got anything to add for strategies there at all?
Yeah, I think from the mental health kind of perspective, I think mental health from an early age, you know, being mindful of mental health and strategies to support mental health is really, really important, particularly post-COVID. Yeah. We also know that for lots of our children with neurodivergent conditions, that actually they can, as a child grows, sometimes be co-occurring mental health difficulties as well. So for me, it's about teaching the skills, the coping strategies, in learning the best ways. When I feel like this is what I need to do about that.
Yeah.
And there's some amazing books out there that you can read. I mean, I obviously work with little ones, and we explore things like The Colour Monster. We've got A Huge Bag of Worries, which is another lovely book. I know for older children, you can get apps. There's one that you can look at called, I think it's Mood Move. If you go on the website, the Cuth website, which is an NHS or Young Minds website.
Is it on there? Yeah.
It's on there, and there's a drop-down resource section.
Great.
Where you can have a little look, and there's some apps that young people can get involved with.
That's really good to know that,
It's building their knowledge. So this is what I've heard the word anxiety, don't we know what it is? But this is what I can learn what it is, and then I can learn how to deal with it. I think that's a really good starting point, and a really positive strength-based way of kind of developing those skills.
Absolutely. Well. Yeah, absolutely. Now all these things we're talking about, the anxiety and everything. I know as a parent, I used to get a bit of COVID anxiety myself, you know, when an email will come in from nursery or school. You knew it was going to be something around COVID, you know, children being sent home. And then there's the worry of, will your child get it? Managing the childcare, home schooling, home working, everything that goes with it. And I'm sure that there'll be plenty of parents listening who have all felt a little bit of what I've just mentioned at one point or another. And so I'm really keen to hear your answer to the next question now. So it's one for parents, really. So how can parents and carers look after themselves, reduce the stress levels, and in a way, sort of move on from COVID, in a way?
I think, do you know what, Claire? I think that's so important to focus on. Because, you know, we've been through a lot, haven't we?
Yeah.
You know, when you think, like, we've juggled working from home. You know, for some people, they've lost jobs, they've lost people. You know, it's been a really tricky long period of time of it as well. And I think acknowledging that and acknowledging that it's been tough is a really good starting point. Mm-hmm. I think something that we do is we use a lot of reflection, because I think it's you know, to reflect. Something that I did with my own family is created, you know, where you can go and you can print photo books off.
Mm-hmm.
There's all ways of doing it. And I looked and reflected at the positives of the lockdowns. I mean, there's lots of good stuff that happened. I spent a lot more time in the sun. There was some lovely moments with my family that I will never take for granted anymore, you know, time.
And the times where you had to like really make an effort to see each other, like, you know, you'd all meet and go for a walk in the place where you'd never been to before, just because you were looking for something that you could all go and do together. So your special times that you might have just gone and sat in each other's house, you know, but you couldn't do that. So you're making a special effort to go and create these times together.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think I've also learned that actually going for a walk and taking my own coffee, my own cup, just as fun as fun. I'm sure there's something that as well.
Oh yeah,
I think it's certainly made me and by having those photo books, I will look back at those and go, wow, I remember that day where my niece turned up at my front door and I wasn't allowed to cuddle her, and how horrible that was. So I now look at my family and I go, I can cuddle you now, and I'm going to
And you appreciate it so much, don't you, that being able to have that time together now.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, so much.
I also think going into the next phase of kind of the pandemic, and, you know, it's not over, but there's lots of changes that have happened that we've had to manage as well. But I always think I like to kind of get all my thoughts down on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And there's a model that you can use where you draw two circles, an inner circle and an outer circle. The inner circle is what can I control? The outer circle is what's out of my control.
Yeah, okay.
In my outer circle, I will write things like what the government decide to do, or what happens when I'm in a shop and somebody, you know, does something that I maybe don't, coughs on me. It's not my control, but what I can control is whether I choose to wear a mask, whether I antibacterialize my hands when I get out of that shop. Mm-hmm. You know, and I suppose, I mean, there's maybe some extreme examples, but just thinking about your own situation.
Yeah.
You have control.
What you can control.
And what you can't we control? And the things that we can't control, they're the things that we need to work to push away. I get that, but actually working on that can be a really good
way
of compartmentalizing it all, I think.
Yeah.
Which I think we need to do, don't we?
Definitely, yeah. And sort of push on forward now. Yeah. No, I like that. I'll probably be going home tonight and do two little circles. Probably end up being a massive piece of paper. But anyway, okay. So I've spoken to so many parents about this next thing I'm going to mention. So many children that were babies at the start of the pandemic are now toddlers or preschoolers. And I say it, you know, because my twins were like 8 months old when it started, and now they're approaching three. They've had a massively different start to their older sisters when they were those ages. And so when we look at the younger children, toddlers, preschoolers of that age range, what are we seeing with them? And are we seeing any differences, you know, to those sort of pre-pandemic kids?
Yeah, we are. And it's difficult because it feels negative. And I think it feels negative because we're getting things in place to support what we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been some recent research that's come out on the impact of COVID on preschool age children or young children. And basically what the research is suggesting to us is that lack of social opportunities is impacting social communication development.
Yeah.
But also which has been really interesting. And actually I'm seeing this in my work, particularly in our reception age children and our year one kids and our nursery children, is weaknesses in physical development as well.
Right, because that period of time and not being out and about sort of thing.
Yeah, so our early years settings are set up with climbing opportunities, outdoor provision, and that outdoor provision is very cleverly planned to allow children to climb, stretch, crawl and all that. And that's an essential stage of early development.
Yeah.
Lots of our children with neurodivergent needs kind of need more of that. They need lots of opportunity for climbing and stretching and crawling. But for lots of children, maybe if they were in flats and didn't have gardens or didn't have access to going to a nursery and having those well-planned areas to play in, actually there's been missed opportunities for that physical development. So we are seeing children coming through now into key stage one, so year one and year two, so 8 year, you know, 7 year olds who physically might have difficulties with postural control.
So,
postural control is really important for sitting and writing and, you know, being able to stay upright without wobbling.
Yeah.
You know, all of that is really important for learning. So, we are seeing an impact, but actually we are also learning what we need to do about it. So, for me, the solution to the problem is let's just indulge these children that have missed these opportunities in what they've missed. So for me, it's that get them climbing, we talk about sensory circuits, which is just a structured activity that you can do at home. It's like a little mini assault course that the kids can do. You can do it with teenagers as well, but where your core activities are centered around being on your tummy, you know, climbing over climbing equipment, crawling under things, crossing the body. So, you know, climbing walls and being on rope swings, you know, using, you know, the fireman's kind of pole, anything like that, anything that's going to get them developing core structure, developing that strength that they need in their body in order to then engage with other aspects of what you need your body for, you know, for sitting for being at the time as well. So, you know, it's the research isn't kind of particularly positive, but we need research to inform us of what strategies we recommend.
So you can put them in place.
Yeah.
Okay. Absolutely. All right, thanks, Emma. So as we look forward to the coming years, what do you think the biggest challenges will be for neurodiverse children and also perhaps for schools as well?
I think it's the, currently we've got this terminology of catch up. There's two phrases I don't like, catch up and school readiness. They're the two,
yeah.
They literally make me cringe. And I understand why they're there. I do understand. But actually, for some children, particularly when we think about children who are neurodiverse, they have, it's neurodevelopmental is a delay in development. So actually, they if a child is diagnosed with ADHD, they are delayed. So it means that they're already starting with a delay. Throw in COVID and the delay that COVID has created for all children. The impact that that's having on our neurodivergent community is quite significant. So I think going forwards, and it's certainly a message that's coming out of our charity, the ADHD Foundation, is that we need to rethink the way we teach, that we need to rethink the way
language used and stuff like that as well. Yeah.
And actually, for me, it's like, it's not about catch up. It's about catching where they've fallen. If that kind of, it sounds really cheesy, but it's like meeting them where they are. You know, like actually, if a child isn't at a stage of sitting and writing, rather than making them do that, let's get them up and climbing and reaching and stretching and developing the core skills that will then lend themselves to writing and fine motor skills and all of that sort of stuff. I think, I have this like kind of maybe a bit of a utopian way of looking at it, but there's so much that we can, you know, that whole what we can control and what we can't control. From the perspective of parents, we can control what activities we facilitate for our children at home. So, you know, thinking about where do we need to catch them and what do we need to put in place for where they've been caught, I suppose.
Yeah.
And strengthen maybe where they're presenting weaknesses are.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay then. So our last sort of point for the day, really. So as we look to a more optimistic and positive future when it comes to COVID, what are the plans for your organisation and their hopes for the future?
We do, you know what, Claire, we have lots.
We
love what
you're all very busy, aren't you?
Very busy, very busy. But do you know, COVID has been a really tough time, but it's also been a really reflective time for us as an organisation. We've got so many exciting things happening over the upcoming year. One big one is, we have our umbrella project, which has been going for a long time.
Yeah.
This year, it's just exploded. You know,
it's massive.
We've got installations in Cheltenham, in Aberdeen.
Fantastic.
All over the place. We've got, we're working with international schools now. I'm going to Germany next week to go and be in an international school out there, which is just really exciting. So, I think for us, it's using the opportunity to, I suppose, when we talked about language of change and change the way we see kind of neurodivergent.
Definitely.
This week, you know, the 21st to the 27th is Neurodiversity Celebration Week.
Yeah.
And we're in it right now. And actually, I attended a panel meeting yesterday where parents and carers were invited to come and just listen. And it was the most positive thing I've experienced in the sense that it was just celebratory of the strengths of neurodiverse.
Yeah, and that's what it's about focusing on, is the strengths, isn't it? We've got to focus on the strengths.
Yeah, absolutely. So, that's certainly what we are kind of the flag for at the ADHD Foundation anyway. And you guys.
And us,
the Slack group as well.
Yeah,
definitely.
Okay. Oh, well, that just about brings us to the end of the podcast today. So another great, a difficult topic to talk about when it comes to COVID and the sense of, you know, loss and everything like that. But also to be able to look at what we can take from it in terms of how we move forward, changing the language we use and the way that children learn and what we need to focus on in terms of, what did you say, Emma? I liked what you said, catching them where,
that, Claire, has literally just come to my mind.
Well, I think I love that. Yeah. I love that. I think I need you to say it again so we can finish the podcast on it.
Yeah, it's not about catch up. It's about catching them where they fell. And then I think a lot of what we do, and it's a very early years way of looking at things, but it's that we need to step in order for us to understand where they are. We need to step in their world, experience things, and understand from their perspective what's going on, you know. And it's that, rather than catch up, you are 7 or you are 8 and you shouldn't be here. And actually, you know, it's not a case of that. It's a case of we need to meet them where they are, because if we don't meet them where they are, they're not going to get to where they need to be.
And it just heightens, when you look at it the other way, the catch up, it heightens the anxiety and everything else around it, which then blocks the progression. And, you know, so it's just a cycle. So, yeah, I love that, Emma. I'm going to say it wrong every time.
It's not about catch up, it's about catching them where they fell.
That's the one. That's what we want to finish up today. Amazing. I might do. No, I love that. So thanks so much to Emma and to everybody who was listening to the podcast. So if you would like to find out more about the support materials that we do have on offer, please visit the website. It's witherslackgroup.co.uk/resources. There's also a huge amount of resources on the ADHD Foundation website as well, covering a wide range of materials and topics relating to neurodiversity. So once again, Emma, always lovely to have you on the podcast. So thank you for your time this morning. Big thanks to our listeners, and I hope you can join us for another episode of Sensational in the future. So bye for now.